This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by
Geppetto Pickups, GeppettoGuitars.com. Guitar players are always searching for the tone that will define their playing identity. Geppetto Pickups' wide spectrum of tones and sonic colors inspire and instill a newfound confidence in the player that comes from having amazing tone. Single coils, humbuckers, and bass pickups wound and constructed by hand to a level of perfection that will finally satisfy that search for tone and enhance your play. Because, let's face it,
when you sound better, you're inspired to play better.
Go to GeppettoGuitars.com. We'll give your guitar its voice, but you'll make it sing.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
Thank you. All right, folks, welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. Our next guest is a journalist, novelist, and photographer. He was a senior writer for Rolling Stone, as well as a contributor to Esquire, NME, Cream, my all-time favorite magazine, Downbeat, Trouser Press, just to name a few. He founded the first web mag, Addicted to Noise, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's here today to discuss his absolutely compelling new book about one of my favorite musicians of all time and somebody that I felt was very, very special human. The book is called Wicked Game, The True Story of Guitarist James Calvin Wilsey. Please welcome to Guitar Radio Show, Mr. Michael Goldberg. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. This is, as I told you off mic, I had spent the last year and a half or so researching a tribute episode to Jimmy, and I really wanted to do it right, and I was really having a tough time gathering information that was accurate about him, you know, about his past and everything else, and out of nowhere, you and I connected, and I found out about this book, and I can't thank you enough for writing this book.
Well, great. Thanks for that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's beautiful story. It's a heart-wrenching story. It really could be a movie, as I also told you off mic. It's such a visual account of his life, particularly his early life. It was so cinematic to read about that information. You know, I mean, I felt like I was there in St. Louis when he saw Bowie. You know, it was really very cinematic. So it took you 3 years to write this. After reading this for me and digesting this story, it seems like to me that this was more of a forensic journal than a bio. And that must have been tough. Was it really a tough chore to do this book?
Well, I wouldn't put it like that. I wrote the book. Jimmy was a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. This was back in the 80s and really at the very beginning of the 90s. We had met in 1982 when I went to a gig, a Silvertone gig. That was a band he was in with Chris Isaak. Mm-hmm. And I met him after the show, and then I subsequently wrote a bunch of stories, half a dozen stories at least, a number of them for Rolling Stone, about Chris Isaak. And each time I did one of those stories, I also talked to Jimmy. And eventually I did a profile of him for Guitar Player. And by then we had become friends, and I would go over to his place, we'd hang out. But anyway, I was absolutely shocked when I read on Facebook on the, you know, Christmas Eve. Well, actually, I read on Christmas Day, but he had died on Christmas Eve Day. Mm-hmm. And there was a post in the Mabue Gardens Facebook group, and I just about fell over. I couldn't believe he was dead. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was just a horrible thing. And he was only 61. And so I waited for the San Francisco Chronicle to write an obituary, because he was an important guy. I mean, he was in the Avengers, who are, you know, arguably the most important punk band to come out of the West Coast, possibly the whole country. I mean, that's what Lenny Kaye has to say. And then he was not only in Silvertone and the Guitar Player with Chris Isaak, but he wrote the key introduction and all the guitar parts for Wicked Game. And as even Chris Isaak has acknowledged, he was very, very important to that song becoming an international top 10 hit. Mm-hmm. And so here's a guy, there should have been an obituary in the San Francisco Chronicle. There wasn't. He was in LA for over 20 years. Nothing in the LA Times, nothing in Billboard. And so after about a week, I contacted an editor that I worked with for years at the Rolling Stone, or who knew for years anyway at Rolling Stone, and you know, they went for the story, and so I was able to write a piece about Jimmy in a timely manner, you know, so that, you know, basically the music world knew about him and that he had died. And then, but I didn't feel like, I felt like there was so much more to his story. And so I wrote a longer piece for another publication I write for. And I still felt like there's more to this story. And so that, you know, basically that initial research that I did for those two articles was just the beginning of the next 3 years. And it was heartbreaking at times, you know, because of how he died. I mean, he ended up homeless. It's a very sad, tragic story. But the thing is, there's also a lot of joy and beauty, because earlier on, I mean, like, you know, when Jimmy was a kid, when he was in high school, when he first came out to San Francisco, when he was in the Avengers, people to this day love Jimmy, but they just loved him back then. I mean, he was a star of the San Francisco punk scene, and he was a really gracious person and at that time. And so, you know, he wrote, like, the Avengers, he wrote the music for the Avengers' greatest song, which is called We Are the One. And, you know, so there's a lot about his creativity. I mean, I had interviewed Jimmy for over 4 hours, and it was for Guitar Player, and at least that was one of the interviews was for Guitar Player, one was for Rolling Stone. And in the course of those interviews, he talked a lot about how he came up with his guitar parts, his introduction riffs, and all of this kind of stuff for various songs. And I found that fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm just like an amateur musician who like plays guitar for fun. But I mean, I thought that, like, you know, actual musicians would find that fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, guitar players who, I mean, I think it's hard to be a guitar player and not just love the tone he got, love mm-hmm. the sound, mm-hmm. you know. He was someone who was so careful with his notes, but mm-hmm. not in a way where when you listen to it, you felt like, oh God, he's just, you know, not in an uptight way, but in a way where what he played was so right for the song. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, riffing.
No.
It was really coming up.
Yeah, he meant it.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, he designed the parts mm-hmm. carefully for the songs. Sometimes they came quickly. Sometimes they came over, you know, months and months. Mm-hmm. You know, they would take, like, the first album, which is called Silvertone. It's a Chris Isaac album, but really, it should be a Jimmy Wilsey, Chris Isaac album.
I agree.
Or maybe even a Chris Isaac, Jimmy Wilsey, Eric Jacobson album.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Jimmy was, and many people have said this, I mean, so it's not just, this isn't just my opinion. Jimmy was responsible for the sound mm-hmm. of you know, of the songs. And then, I mean, Chris Isaac wrote and sang the songs, But you know, the songs without Jimmy, I mean, well, you can see the difference. I mean, because Jimmy was on the first 3.5 albums,
mm-hmm.
and then you start getting to later Chris Isaac albums, and they don't have that sound.
No, it's completely different.
They're missing it. And
yes.
And they don't even, well, anyway, we don't have to get into that. But, I mean, it was a very, very sad thing that the two of them parted ways. Mm-hmm. You know, that's another sad part of this story, because I really felt like, you know, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, or Paul McCartney and John Lennon. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously those are big, huge bands, and Silvertone, you know, Chris Isaac, you know, wasn't such a huge, you know, I mean, they had that big hit, but you know, it's on a smaller scale, but still, you have situations where there are a pair of musicians, or sometimes more than just two, who have a period of time where they just, everything they create kind of is just incredible from a musical point of view, from a listening point of view, whether it's a hit or not.
Yeah, they were,
you know what I mean?
They were perfect for each other. They complemented each other perfectly. How did they meet?
Well, what happened was, okay, Chris Isaac was coming up to the Bay Area. He was trying to get a band together, and meanwhile, this guy named Mark Plummer, who was a journalist in England, had moved to the United States, was really interested in managing punk musicians and working with punk musicians, and he ended up in San Francisco. First, he was in LA, came up to San Francisco, and he was working with some bands, and he was at a party, and someone put a cassette tape on, and he heard this guy singing a George Jones song, and he just flipped, and it was a terrible tape, terrible recording, but he just flipped over it, and he was trying to find out who the guy was, and all he knew was the guy was Chris from Stockton. Well, anyway, he got finally found, Isaac, and basically they had a conversation and they hit it off, and so he became Isaac's manager, and so Isaac wanted to get this band together, and so Mark was asking Chris, you know, well, what are the musicians you like? Who would you like in your band? One of them was John Silvers. Another one, Chris had heard the Avengers. He wanted Jimmy Wilsey on bass. And so Mark Plummer contacted Wilsey, but Wilsey wasn't interested in that. He didn't want to play bass. He wanted to play guitar. And then he didn't know who this guy was, because, you know, nobody at that point, Chris Isaac was just another guy, mm-hmm. you know, who played guitar and sang. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he didn't do that. So meanwhile, Chris Isaac, they got a trio together, and Chris was playing around a bit, and played some shows at the Mabue Gardens. And at a certain point, they needed somebody to work this Echoplex unit that they wanted to use with Chris's voice, you know, to get that sort of Sun Records Echo thing happening.
Right.
And so they asked Jimmy, because Jimmy was due at that point, the Avengers were over. Jimmy was just kind of doing all kinds of different musical stuff. And so so John Silvers, the drummer, asked Jimmy if that was something he would help them out with. And so Jimmy started kind of doing their sound, basically. And after the shows, and before the shows, he would go backstage and he would show Chris guitar parts, because Chris was trying to play, you know, the rhythm and the lead guitar himself.
Mm.
And they were doing a lot of covers, a lot of rockabilly covers at that point. And Jimmy knew all the riffs, and he could show, you know, he could just show him, hey, this is how you do it. This is the notes. This is the deal. And so the two of them hit it off. And at a certain point, Chris wasn't happy with the trio, so he broke the trio up, and him and Jimmy started just working together informally, and at a certain point, they decided to form a new version of this band, Silvertone, and they got a bass player, Jimmy found a bass player, and then they decided to ask John Silvers back, and that's how the first version of the band that Chris and Jimmy were in together got formed, and how the two of them met.
That's wild. Okay, I had heard the story about the cassette tape, but that I didn't hear about the Echoplex and all that. That's interesting. That's interesting. I tell you, you know, it's funny. We were talking earlier about the you know, I'll quote the book. You wrote here, by 1982, you had seen a lot of bands, but none like Silvertone. When you heard Silvertone, particularly Isaac's voice and Jimmy's guitar, it was as if you were witnessing a great band the world had somehow missed out on, that slipped through the cracks. A band that combined 50s rockabilly, I love this, 50s rockabilly, 60s pop, 80s punk nihilism, Elvis fronting the Beatles, only with the anxiety of the Joy Division. I was like, that's perfect way to describe it.
Thank you.
That's a perfect way, because there was that tension between Jimmy's guitar playing and the urgency, desperation of Chris's voice that worked so well together.
Absolutely.
You know, and it just sucked you in, like millions of others. And I can say that very assuredly, like millions of others. The very first time I heard James play was Wicked Game. And I know exactly, it was like the day the earth stood still. I remember where I was. I was in my bedroom. I was holding my guitar. I had the radio on, and I heard that opening riff. And
yeah, two notes, basically.
I was gobsmacked. I was, what the hell is that? And how the hell do I do that? How do I? Because it reached inside me and turned me upside down. It rearranged my musical DNA that day. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever heard. And of course, as soon as I found out, I did, at that point, I didn't know how to get the record. It was really weird. But I knew that it was in the David Lynch film. So just so I could hear it again, I went to see the film. And then, of course, I ended up, you know, going crazy, and I went to my local record store and I bought the cassette tape of it and played it over and over again and learned how to play that.
But when you went to see Wild at Heart, the David Lynch film, it's in. What you heard was the instrumental version, so you even more got to hear guitar.
Right, I got even more out of it, which was perfect in the movie. It was perfectly casted in the film. From that moment on, that's when I started going backwards, and I went and looked at the other two records at that point that were out, the Silvertone record and then the second record, which was called just Chris Isaac. But, you know, it's so funny how people always, you know, they talk about that song, and that's, you know, it's indelible. He is known for that. That's Jimmy's signature piece. But, you know, it's crazy because, like, the solo in Wild Love and Waiting for the Rain to Fall, you know, those are amazing guitar solos. Those are amazing, amazing representations of his talent.
And, or You Owe Me Some Kind of Love. I mean, the guitar for it's just amazing.
Absolutely.
And the opening track on the first album, Dancing.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that builds through that song is just, and the way that it's like the voice and the guitar together build to this total point of desperation.
Absolutely. And Blue Hotel as well. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's just astounding to me. And he was one of those guys that I was like, why? You know, and I would tell people about him all the time. I would say, have you heard this cat? This guy's outrageously good, you know? And it was an interesting time too, because that was the time of all these shredding guitar players and hair bands. And I know I was in a hair band. I remember that time period, you know. And so it was so left of center as far as guitar was concerned. And it was, I think that's part of the reason why so many guitar players were enamored by it, because it was so fresh and it was so different. And, you know, even though it was borrowing from the past, it was something new.
Well, yeah. And I mean, one thing that I just love this, Mark Plummer, you know, the original manager, he was in New York. They were in New York. This was in 1985. They were doing some gigs in New York. The first album had just come out, and they were at this hotel, and Mark Plummer is walking through the halls, and he hears what sounds like Jimmy playing, you know, one of his riffs. Yeah. And but it's coming from a room that wasn't Jimmy's room. So he's thinking, I guess Jimmy must have switched rooms or something. So he knocks on the door because he wants to, you know, make sure or whatever. And the door is opened by Johnny Marr of the Smiths. And he was playing Jimmy's riff and was a huge fan of Jimmy. And so Mark hooked them up, you know, because they were both in the same hotel. But I mean, I just thought, when I heard that, I mean, that was, you know, that was early on. And here you got a guy from the Smiths who's playing, you know, Jimmy's riffs. I just thought that was tremendous.
That's an amazing, I love that story. That's part of the reason I love this book so much, is because the book is filled with all sorts of cool stories like that. Boy, to be a fly on the wall for that conversation between Johnny Marr and James Wilson.
Well, Jimmy was very low key and sort of quiet when he spoke. Mm-hmm. And so I could just see them just kind of hanging out, and almost, I mean, if anything, maybe Jimmy would have gotten his guitar, or maybe Johnny had a couple of guitars in there, and I could just see them just kind of playing a little bit together or something. You know, I mean, I don't know. I didn't talk to Johnny Marr about that. I mean, Jimmy was just a real sort of low key, especially at that point. He didn't come across as an egomaniac in any way. Mm-hmm. At that point in his life. But he took playing music very seriously. But he was a really funny guy, and he saw humor in many things, and he had a real sort of dark black humor.
Oh, it was wonderful. And that was one of the things that, you know, when years later, when he took to Facebook, he and I became Facebook friends. And his posts would have me in stitches, you know, from everything to, you know, it's funny because I was actually went back and looked at his Facebook page today. And there's hysterical pictures of women's high heeled pumps, but they're made to look like they're covered in scrotum skin with pubic hair on them. it's so like disarming to the, you know, it's like, oh, you look at it, you go, ooh, and then you look, and then you laugh. You can't help but laugh. And it's really, it's incredibly funny. And, you know, it got to the point where, you know, I started commenting on his posts. He would comment on mine. And then I started messaging him because I really wanted to interview him in the worst way. And I would say to him often enough, I'd say, you know, come on the show, man. I would love to talk about your career. And he said, and I remember him saying to me, he would say, soon, I've got things coming up. But we unfortunately, we never got him on. And, you know,
when was that? What time period?
That's got to be just prior to Trump era.
He died in, you know, December of 2018.
Right.
So Trump was elected in 2016, I think, right?
So yeah. we were talking from, I think, 2012 on until about October of 2017 or 18. I'm not sure which it was. But I think his last post was October of 2018. I think the last time he posted, and it was a picture of him and Chris.
Yeah, it was. And he had had a period where he kind of had kind of gone silent for a while on Facebook.
Yeah.
And then came back, you know, came back again.
He would give me advice about Stratocasters because I was always searching for the right one, and he knew them so well because that was his instrument. It was always, you know, I felt like I was really being schooled, you know, properly when he would talk about gear. What happened to his gear, do you know?
Well, sadly, he sold or pawned a number of things, and then he got you know, more guitars later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he went through these periods where he was really messed up, and then he would clean up for a while, and whatever he had left went to his son, and kind of luckily there was a point where he had moved up to the Bay Area. This was in 2016, the fall, and when he moved up to the Bay Area, he brought all his stuff that he had at that point, that, you know, that he was keeping, and then at a certain point, his girlfriend he moved in with his girlfriend. She kicked him out because of his drug problems, and so he took everything to Arizona, where his sisters live, and he was staying with one of his sisters for a while. So his stuff got put in storage. Most of it got put in storage, mm. And so when he came back down to LA in 2017, he brought some equipment, but not a ton of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had enough so he could record and play, but a lot of stuff and guitars and stuff were left in Arizona, so that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know, and I'm not sure the situation of the, you know, instruments and things that he had in LA at the
right
time he died. I'm not sure about that.
I just appreciated, you know, his wit and his candor, his honesty. He was, you know, not just in his guitar playing, but in the things that he said, the things that he would post. And it was, sometimes he'd have me in stitches. It was really funny. You know, you have a whole chapter dedicated to the Wilsey sound, which I absolutely, you know, as a guitar geek, that was so thrilling that you put that in there. I was really appreciative of that. And you had mentioned that the guitarist that had influenced Jimmy was obviously Scotty Moore, Duane Eddy, Hank Marvin of the Shadows, Don Rich, Link Wray, George Harrison, Keith Richards, Billy Strange, and James Burton. But it's amazing how he was able to take just sort of like essences of these individuals and then do something completely different, something completely fresh and new to everybody's ear. Not a lot of people can do that. Usually it's just regurgitation. With Jimmy, it wasn't. It was felt brand new.
Well, he was really, I mean, I think he was kind of a creative genius.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, I don't know if that's too strong a word, but I mean, he came up with these riffs,
mm-hmm.
and you hadn't heard the riffs before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really hadn't. I mean, no one had, I mean, obviously the Wicked Game riff is the most known one, but I mean, that riff is so simple. It's two notes, but the way he plays those two notes, and as he himself said, he could teach anybody to play that. He said, I can teach anyone to play this in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. They don't have to have ever played the guitar before. It's that simple. But, you know, that was the brilliance of it, that it was so simple.
Yeah.
And yet so moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, as Lenny Kaye said, I mean, it just leads you into that song.
Yeah.
I mean, the best introduction guitar intros to songs do that. You know, they're perfectly in sync mm-hmm. with the song, but they catch your attention, right? You know, it's the first note catches your attention.
Yeah.
And then you're just like pulled right into the song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's a rare thing.
Yeah.
For, you know, to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards obviously took, you know, so much from, you know, Chuck Berry the many, you know, blues guitarists.
Hubert Sumlin, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, sure. But what he played with the Rolling Stones was unique on their songs. You know, he was able to do that. You know, so there are guitar players that can do that. Jimmy was one of those, you know, mm-hmm. who the influences were just sort of the platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. Absolutely. I agree. You mentioned in the book also about on YouTube, there's a show from 85 at the I-Beam that I think it stands as it's a really excellent representation of how important Jimmy was to the overall sound of the band. It's really, I mean, he is just, his guitar is engulfing the entire sound of that show. It's incredible. Folks, if you go to guitarradioshow.com, I will have a link to that. You'll be able to see it. It's the video quality is pretty awful, but the sound quality is pretty darn good, considering it's 1985 and it was probably done with a handheld video camera of some kind.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's a great representation.
Yeah.
And of what they sounded like then.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have, you know, other bootleg recordings from that time, and they were just so great then. I mean, it was just like, you know, and you could see them in the smallest clubs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did their when their album came out, when the Silvertone album came out, they played a series of shows at this little club called the Nightbreak on Haight Street, which was like about a block and a half from Golden Gate Park. And that club is tiny, like 100, 150 people, something like that. And I mean, you know, you could just go in there and you could get, so you were, you know, 10 feet from the front of the stage
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, just let that music just like envelop, you know, you just be surround you. I mean, it was, and the I-Beam shows at the I-Beam were really great as well. These were just like small San Francisco clubs.
Yeah.
And, they were so good during that, basically from then through when Jimmy left the band you know in 1992. I mean, they were exceptional, and so they had really hardcore fans who would go see them over and over again.
It's a really great performance. I highly recommend everybody check it out. What can you tell us about the period around 2008 when he released El Dorado?
Well, he at that point he was working doing IT at this Hollywood marketing company that did marketing for all. For movies, And it was like the, I believe, sort of the top company in LA that did that. And he worked there from 2002 until 2008. And while during the time he was working there, at one point, a friend of his ex-wife formed a band. Actually, they were still married at this point, actually. Okay, so a friend of his wife at the time, this woman Liz McGrath, formed a band called Ms. Derringer. And it was a very country-influenced, country rock kind of a band. And basically, it was because of Jimmy that she even cared at all about country music. Because he basically, well, it's a long story, that we don't need to go into that. But anyway, she formed this band. And at a certain point, Jimmy got on board to play guitar and to help the band sort of get their music together. Because he was really good at that. And so Jimmy played live for about 6 months or so in 2005 in Ms. Derringer. And that kind of got him like, hey, I can still do this. You know, I can still play live. I could, you know, because he hadn't been playing live for years. So he had been talking about doing an album, a solo album at one point, anyway, for years, and he had a bunch of songs, and so he quit Ms. Derringer, and he started really, really focusing on recording the album that became El Dorado, and he did the whole thing in the dining room of a Craftsman house in Eagle Rock, you know, in LA, and you know, on his computer, and for most of the guitar, he used these what are they? They're like, it's like software that you can, you know, you could just plug directly into your computer. I mean, I'm sure you know about this, and I'm sure most of the guitarists listening to this know about this, but you know, you plug into your computer and you use the software, creates the sound of a particular amp. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can do all the, you know, do all this tweaking of it and get it to sound just how you want it. And so that's how he recorded most of the guitar on the, you know, on El Dorado. And so he spent, I don't know, a year or more, you know, laying down all the tracks. And so he wasn't really, I mean, he sent it to Eric Jacobson. And I should just say, for those of you who don't know who Eric Jacobson is, Eric Jacobson produced a half dozen or so top 10 hits for the Love and Spoonful in the mid-60s. He also produced, he basically found and produced Tim Hardin, who Bob Dylan thinks is one of the great songwriters of all time.
Wow.
Eric Jacobson subsequently did the song Spirit in the Sky, which was a huge hit for a guy named Norman Greenbaum. Mm-hmm. And he did some other things. And so he was an important, you know, producer back in the 60s. Well, he, you know, he ended up hooking up with and becoming both the co-manager and the producer of, you know, first it was Silvertone and then it was Chris Isaak. And so, you know, Eric was definitely a key part of what I think of as the trio, you know, him, Jimmy, and Chris Isaak, who made those first three records, and made them as great as they are.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so Jimmy, you know, sent the tape to Eric, but by that point, Eric really wasn't doing any producing anymore. So, and Eric kind of felt like, and I don't agree with this, but Eric felt like he really needed Chris Isaak to sing on the songs to really make them work. And maybe if you were thinking from trying to get a hit record with it, maybe that's true. But if you were just looking at it from the point of view of music, then no. I mean, it's a great instrumental album.
I love it.
And so other than contacting Jimmy and putting some stuff up on, at that point it was like MySpace, I guess, was the, is that?
Yeah.
Is that the music, big music site? Yeah, MySpace.
Well,
okay.
There was MySpace, and then there was, that was MySpace before Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was the place. So he had a page there, but what happened was, there's this company. It's a movie company, really, and so the guy in the music department at this company, Lakeshore, I guess it is. He's talking to a friend of his, and he's saying, telling this friend of his, you know, what we want to do is we want to find great artists who are not, for whatever reason, are not recording right now, and who can make music that would be appropriate for movies, because I want to create this sort of library of great stuff, so when a movie comes along, we can just plug it in. And so the guy says, well, do you know who Jimmy Wilsey is? Because Jimmy's got this album, and it's an instrumental album, and it sounds like it's, you know, right up your alley. And the guy says, Jimmy Wilsey, of course I know Jimmy Wilsey. I mean, he played that iconic riff, you know, from Wicked Game. And he said, and you know what, back then I was doing promotion for Warner Brothers. I actually worked on Wicked Game. And so, you know, that's, you know, basically, Jimmy got hooked up with this guy, and they did a deal. And so then Jimmy did a little bit more work on the album, but it was pretty much done. So the album came out, but even before the album came out, even though Jimmy had said, he posted on Facebook, I mean, he said he wasn't going to play live. He had decided he wasn't going to play live. But next thing you know, he put an instrumental band together, the James Wilsey Orchestra, and so in the fall of 2007, they started doing some gigs around LA.
Mm-hmm.
And then the album came out in January of 2008, and then they did this fantastic gig at this big guitar festival.
Yeah, Deke Dickerson's. You know, Deke Dickerson.
Deke puts on one day of this multi-day, you know, event. He puts on a show, and has all these great, you know, guitar players play, mm-hmm. you know, with their bands.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so the James Wilsey Orchestra played, and luckily someone recorded the whole set.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on YouTube.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you can listen to it.
Yeah.
And it's like 36 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And you could see Jimmy. And Jimmy is, at that point, he's just great as the leader of an instrumental band. And he just has a real presence.
I love that record. It's so, once again, cinematic, right? It's the one of the great headphone albums, you know, listening to it with headphones on, because there's so much going on. There's so many layers and everything else. There's a part of the book where you talk about him purchasing Sly Stone's Bass 6. And there's a lot of Bass 6 on El Dorado. I wonder if that's the Bass 6.
No, it was, that was gone by then.
Oh,
no,
bummer.
El Dorado is probably a Dan Electro bass.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's what he would have used at that point.
The Bass 6 work on that record is stupendous. It's just wonderful. Folks, once again, go to guitarradioshow.com. You'll find links to that Deke Dickerson Guitar Geek Festival James played at. I've watched that probably a dozen times.
Oh yeah, I have too.
It's so good.
Yeah, and then there's these other on YouTube recordings, you know, videos of Jimmy playing songs from El Dorado, as well as a couple of songs not on El Dorado that are just fantastic. I mean, his version of the song Superstar is tremendous.
Yeah, yeah,
just tremendous.
Can you tell us a little bit about Killing Them Softly?
There's a in the actual movie, there's a Johnny Cash song, and for whatever reason, they could use the song in the movie, but they couldn't use it on the soundtrack. And so according to the guy at the record company, the song is called "The Man Comes Around," and it's, you know, it's a Johnny Cash song, and the guy at the record company was like, "You can't cover Johnny Cash. You just can't do it because it's never going to come anywhere close to Johnny Cash." Mm-hmm. But he felt that if anyone could do it, it was going to be Jimmy. And what's funny is, and I don't know if it's funny, but when Jimmy was a kid, when he was in high school, and that's when he started playing guitar, and he would, these houses back in, he lived in Florissant, St. Louis, Missouri, which is right, it's like a suburb outside of St. Louis. And so Jimmy, you know, they would jam in the basement, and Jimmy's mom, when they got too loud, you know, they're playing, jamming on Stone songs or something, she would kind of come stick her head down, you know, at the door, you know, where the stairs are going down to the basement, and kind of yell, "Come on, can't you play something good?" And so then he would play like Johnny Cash songs. And so all these years later, I mean, you know, he recorded a version of Killing Them Softly, and of The Man Comes Around, for the movie that ended up on the soundtrack for the movie Killing Them Softly. Mm-hmm. And that was really the last thing that he did, the most recent thing that he did that appeared on record.
Right.
There was another. He played on the Miss Derringer song, their version of Unchained Melody, which only came out in 2017 on an EP, but that was recorded before Man Comes Around. So that was really the last song of his that appeared on a record.
And the Killing Me Softly stuff, that was there are demos of that, right, on SoundCloud.
You can hear the song on, I believe, on Amazon. You can buy the song. You can for 99 cents or whatever. You know, you could. I don't know that. I don't think that is on SoundCloud. There is a bunch of Jimmy's stuff on SoundCloud, stuff that's never been released, and also some a few live recordings back with Chris Isaac as well.
Oh, that's interesting. That I haven't found. I got to go look for that. That's cool.
Yeah. No, there's cool stuff there. I mean, definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, for sure. So we've been talking about the book. I love it. It's so great. I'm like 1.5 times through it already. I read it all the way through, and then I started reading it again. So how do folks go and get the book?
Okay, well, the best place to get the book is directly from the publisher. The publisher is Hozac, H-O-Z-A-C, Records and Books. And this guy, this company, Hozac, it's a small independent company. They've been putting out great records for years, and they've been putting out books as well for a number of years. And the thing that's so cool about this company is that the guy who runs it, his name is Todd Novak, is a total music fanatic. I mean, you know, he's as much as a music fan as you are or I am. I mean, a really serious, you know, and that's why he's doing this. It's like, I love music. I want to put records out. I want to put books about music out. And yeah, of course, I want to make a living. But, you know, this is first and foremost about music that I love. And so he's put out subsequently really cool books. I mean, he put out one that's called The White Label Promo Preservation Society, which is basically, it's the subtitle is 100 Flop Albums You Want to Know. Albums that music critics think are fantastic that were never popular.
Mm.
So there's a whole book, you know, and he's got great, great, great writers that contributed to that. That's the kind of book that he does. Mm. And so anyway, you know, buying directly from his website means, because I'm donating 25% of my royalties to Jimmy's son, whose name is Waylon Wilsey. And it's, you know, Waylon does not have a father because his father's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I mean, his mother's still alive, but that's a whole other story. Subsequently, Waylon, after Jimmy died, one of his relatives became his guardian. And I mean, Waylon just turned 18, so now he doesn't have a guardian, but till he turned 18, she was his guardian, this woman in Arizona. And you know, but Waylon basically now, you know, I mean, he's got the support of these family members, great support from his aunts and from his nieces, you know. But anyway, so I decided that I was going to donate 25% of my royalties to Waylon, and so the publisher is donating a percentage as well to Waylon.
Oh, that's great.
And so Waylon gets the most money, I get the most money, and the indie publisher get the most money if you buy the book directly from them.
Okay.
And for the initial month or so, month or 2 months or whatever, that's going to be the only place you can get the book. So that's the thing. The thing to do is to go there, and it's also the cheapest place you'll be able to get it.
Right.
Yeah. So if you could put a link on.
Absolutely, we'll do that.
You know, that would be really cool.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah. Once again, go to guitarradioshow.com. In the show notes, you will find a link to Hozac, and you'll be able to go directly there to link up and buy the book directly from there. Yeah, absolutely. Man, it's. I think that's great that you're doing that, and I think it's great that the publisher is doing that. That's really, really great.
Yeah, I just thought that, like, I don't know. It just that was like the first thing I thought when I started seriously working on the book, was like, I want to give some of the money to, you know, to Waylon. And I mean, this book is a labor of love. I got to tell you, it's not, this is not, I'm not going to make any money off of this book. I don't
right.
think, I mean, you know, I mean, you know, but it's just something that I had to do.
Well, I'm so glad you did it because I so wanted to know all of this information, and you know, being such a huge fan of his work, and enjoying you know, him in the way that I got to enjoy him at the end of his life, it was so introspective. And you know, I did not know to the extent, you know, really didn't know that he had had this bad a problem early on. And, you know, if anything, also this book is an amazing, you know, public service announcement to the world about addiction.
The thing was, that of course is the tragic part of Jimmy's life is that he started using heroin in the mid 80s, and then he used it, you know, at some points, you know, he was basically chipping, and another, which is, you know, when you're just kind of using it to maintain, but you're not sort of deep into it. And then at other points he was deep into it.
Right.
And it really messed him up, you know.
Yeah.
Seriously messed him up. And so there's a real sad side of the whole thing. And I mean, really, I feel like this book is, part of it is, one of the things it is the story of the dark side of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of the dark side of the music business.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, Jimmy, it's of course Jimmy's story, but it's the story of there's a lot of musicians.
Oh yeah.
That various aspects of this is their lives. I mean,
yeah.
Even if they didn't become addicts, they were like in the band, but they never really benefited from the success of the band.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They musicians who didn't get their names on songs, musicians who, parted ways with
mm-hmm.
the singer for various reasons. So that's another thing that I think any musician would find a lot of interesting information about that side of things.
Yeah.
In this book.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of addiction, I mean, I did a fair amount of research about addiction. I really wanted to try to get at the root of why people become addicted to drugs or alcohol or both. I think if someone reads this book, they're going to get a pretty good idea about that and about the things that happen and can happen in one's lives early on that can have a real impact.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't mean, for example, Jimmy's family moved around quite a bit when he was a kid.
Yeah.
That can be a factor in becoming addicted. But doesn't mean, though, that you have to become addicted.
Right.
Just because that happened, you know. I mean, there is choice in these things, but if there's too many of these things like pile up on top of each other, and you don't know, you know, you just don't know. Then, I don't think Jimmy thought he was going to become an addict when he first started smoking heroin.
No.
Nobody does.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's multiple stories in this story, in this book. I mean, the book is also the story of Chris Isaak.
Yeah.
And it's the story of the band, of the punk band, the Avengers, and to some degree, the San Francisco punk scene.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to do a bunch of things in writing this book. But of course, the key thing was to have Jimmy's story documented and available so that anyone who cared about his music or got interested in him would actually be able to find out about him.
Who do you think would play him in the movie?
Oh, God. I am not good at that. Who do you think would play him in the movie?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it. You know, I don't know, maybe Sebastian Stan, the guy who played the in one of those Marvel movies. I can't think of the name of the character that he played, the something soldier, Winter Soldier.
What about Johnny Depp? Johnny Depp actually played a rockabilly, sort of a rockabilly.
In Crybaby. In the John Waters Crybaby film, right?
No, it's another movie. What's it called? It's an early film that he did. Let me see if I can tell you what it is. I mean, I just watched it recently. I might be able to find it.
I think if Johnny was a little younger, yes.
Yeah, right. You know, that's the problem.
Playing the 80s version of James would be very difficult.
You're right.
But playing James at the end, I think Johnny could definitely do that. Absolutely.
Yeah. You might have to have a couple of actors.
Maybe. Actually. Maybe. I mean, this really would be a great film. It really would. I think it would be a really amazing story to see on film. It really would be. But before I let you go, I have to talk to you about, I know this November, you have a new book coming out.
Yeah, I mean, the Wilsey book is coming out now.
Right.
But in November, I have a book that is a collection of my music journalism. And it includes interviews and profiles of just a huge number of musicians. I mean, Bob Dylan, John Lee Hooker, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Prince, Lou Reed, Laurie Anderson, Neil Young, the Flamin' Groovies, San Francisco punk band Crime. There's a piece on the Ramones. There's a piece on the Sex Pistols. Patti Smith. Long interview with Patti Smith. Very in-depth interview. And a bunch of Robbie Robertson. There's a story about Brian Wilson. There's a story about Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. Rick James. I did a jailhouse interview with Rick James.
Oh, that sounds trippy.
As well as a big piece for Rolling Stone when Rick James was having his Super Freak hit. Both of those are in there.
Oh, cool.
And again, there's also two pieces on James Brown. One is a piece when James Brown went and visited, played for prisoners in San Quentin Prison. And then there's another one later after he had his two-state car chase.
Oh, wow.
When he was high on angel dust. Big, that was the Rolling Stone cover story. So there's, it's a 400-page book.
I remember reading that cover story.
Oh, cool.
Yes, cool. I absolutely remember reading that cover because I was fascinated, because I love James. And
I love him too. I love his music.
Yeah.
I love his music so much. But there was this real dark side to him that had never really been told.
Right.
And that story is about, about the dark side.
Yeah.
And, former musicians who had worked with him for years talked to me about him. And But anyway, so this book is called Addicted to Noise: The Music Writings of Michael Goldberg, and it's going to be out on Backbeat Books in November. It pulls together stuff that I did for Rolling Stone, I started this website, Addicted to Noise. It has some interviews that I did for Addicted to Noise. It has pieces that were in the New Musical Express, that were in a piece on The Clash that was in Downbeat. It's 45 or so years of my career. The best stuff is in the book. Okay. Interviews with Frank Zappa.
Oh, wow.
Short pieces, very short little takes with Muddy Waters and Professor Longhair and Captain Beefheart and Towns Van Zandt.
Will you come back when that comes out and we'll do another interview about it?
I'd love to.
Okay, great.
Yeah, there is a lot we could talk about.
Oh,
that.
I'm good.
Thanks.
I'll sink my teeth into that one for sure.
Cool.
Absolutely. Well, I got to tell you, this has been amazing. And I'm going to surround this interview with a whole bunch of music that folks can hear of James playing. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time out to talk with us.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me again. And it's been a lot of fun to talk about this stuff. Talk about Jimmy.
Once again, folks, the book is called Wicked Game, The True Story of Guitarist James Calvin Wilsey. And it's by Michael Goldberg. It's great. I highly recommend it. Even if you don't know who James was, this is an excellent read. And it'll send you down the rabbit hole to want to listen to this amazing music as well.
Oh, one more thing people should know about the book. It's also a long book. It's 414 pages, mm-hmm. but it includes 150 photographs and flyers and the photographs are by some of the best photographers. I mean, the avant-garde artist Bruce Conner, a couple of photos from him, Marcus Leatherdale, who photographed the Avengers back then.
Photos by you.
Yeah, a bunch of photos that I took. Photo Chester Simpson, Hugh Brown, Ruby Ray, Sue Brisk, and others. I mean, these are people who know rock photography will know some of those names. I'm just really excited about the artwork that illustrates the book, too.
I love
that. I just wanted to get that in.
I love that photo that you took of Patty.
Oh, yes.
Wow,
thank you.
That's a killer shot. That is great. Really good. Well, Michael, thank you again. I appreciate you being here and spending time with us to talk about this. This has been so cool.
Very good.
All right. You hold on 1 second. We're going to sign off right here, and we're going to take us out with something from the El Dorado record.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, guitarradioshow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
GRS Productions.
BMF Effects, BMFFX.com, built by hand in Southern California. BMF Effects captures the tones in your record collection and brings them to life. Overdrive, fuzz, wah, boosts, chorus, compressor, and vibe pedals with a purpose. Purchase online at BMFFX.com or BMF Effects official shop on Reverb. Enhance your tone and playing experience today with BMF Effects, BMFFX.com. Great tone made simple.